Thank you. So this is actually my thesis work, which was done at U of T. I'm now at Waterloo. My thesis work was about cost-effectiveness in clinical trials. And what I want to share with you is that looking back, I see that a large part of my contribution was actually to just fill in some gaps where, for some reason, biostatisticians weren't thinking like biostatisticians. And my innovation was to come in and think like regular biostatisticians think and fill in these gaps, which actually led to some quite big improvements in terms of efficiency. I was going to talk about several gaps. I'm just going to stick to one because it's Friday afternoon and keep things simple. So why do we study cost effectiveness? Over the last half century, the rise in evidence-based medicine has meant that we've got much better at treating disease. For example, Parkinson's, childhood leukemia, we're much better at treating those than we were 20 years ago. However, that's come at an increased cost. And I was writing my thesis during an election year. It was both the federal elections and the in Ontario. And you couldn't miss the fact that we're running Sounds good. When I face this way, it's better. For example, in Ontario, what do we fund on OHIP? Or if you're in a different province, what should your health insurance plan fund in order to deliver best effectiveness? The cornerstone of evidence-based medicine is the clinical trial. So the idea of evidence is that instead of basing clinical practice on what we've always done, we want to base it on evidence. The sort of gold standard of evidence here is a clinical randomized treatment, follow them up for a while, two groups. And as statisticians, we've got used to estimating the mean difference in groups in terms. It's kind of fading in and out. How's that?
No. I got it?
It doesn't sound like it.
There we go.
Thank you.
All right. So statisticians were used to estimating the mean difference between treatment and control in terms of effectiveness, and that might be, say, 5-year survival time. You might want to compare those two between the groups, and we're used to doing that. We're good at that. We call it delta E. What was new, people started collecting cost data around the 1980s, was estimating the mean difference in cost. And then, but supposing we did manage to estimate this thing called delta C, we'd be interested in balancing cost and effectiveness. So from the health policy point of view, how do we deliver best effectiveness within a finite budget? From the statistician's view, what do we do with the data? So in terms of decision maker, how do they make their decisions? A key concept that people came up with, which comes from health economics, so it's kind of a little bit outside my area of expertise, so don't ask too many questions, is the willingness to pay. Where there's some sort of thing which we're going to call lambda, which is how much society is willing to pay for unit increase in effectiveness. How high you've prepared your taxes to be, how much are you prepared to pay in your insurance premiums. Once we know this thing called lambda, the idea people came up with was this notion of an incremental net benefit, which is lambda times delta E minus delta C. And this is key because if the INB is bigger than zero, that means that your benefits and effectiveness outweigh the costs you adopt treatment. If your INB is less than zero, your benefits don't outweigh the costs, you retain standard. So for example, if your trial treatment is both more effective and costs less, so then delta E will be positive, delta C will be negative, that will always be positive, you always adopt the trial treatment. In practice, we don't know exactly what delta E and delta C are. They're estimated. So what statisticians said to the health economists was, we need to quantify some uncertainty around this. And just in the way of sort of explaining why, trying to explain why people were thinking about problems the way they did, it was a huge effort to come up with this quantity. Because this is a nice quantity because asymptotically, it's going to have a normal distribution because we're taking means, you're subtracting them, it's still going to be normal. What the health economists wanted to look at was something they call the incremental cost effectiveness ratio, which is the ratio of delta C over delta E. And their decision rule was exactly the same as what it is with the incremental net benefit. It's just rather messy to express. The problem that people had when they initially just adopted this incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, because that was what health economists did, was that they were trying to put a confidence interval on it. Now, that's not asymptotically normal distribution, because it's the ratio of two things which are normal. So it has this funny distribution. What's more, if delta E is close to zero, your confidence interval will tend to include both plus infinity and minus infinity. Now, you're mathematicians, that's not a problem for you. But if you go to policymakers and you say, oh, this confidence interval has plus infinity, it has minus infinity, they're going to go, what? Like, that doesn't really help them very much. So in what I say in the next few minutes, I'm going to say, well, they missed some really obvious things. But just to give you perspective, this was a huge step forward to start thinking about these nice linear things rather than these weird ratios. So calculating differences in means sounds awfully straightforward, doesn't it? In practice, patients will often withdraw from a study before it's finished, and that's fine. They're allowed to do that. They may move away. They may just decide they don't want to participate. And that leads to censoring. Patients who survive longer, if you think about it, are more likely to be censored because they've been in the trial longer. They're more likely to drop out. And that means that censoring is informative in the sense that if we just look at patients who completed the trial, you tend to get biased results, and this is a problem. Now, we're used to censoring in other, when we're looking at things like survival time. What's rather tricky with cost data is that it's heavily skewed. You tend to have a few patients who cost a lot. So it's difficult to model parametrically, and people have done research which shows that sometimes the estimated mean can be quite sensitive to your choice of parametric distribution, which isn't a good thing. The knee-jerk reaction which statisticians have to that is, well, let's work with a median. The problem is that from the point of view of the person who pays out the money, on average, you pay out the mean, not the median. See, with cost effectiveness, you must study the means. And this was another big hurdle that people had to realize, we must study means, not medians. Lastly, cost data are autocorrelated, so your cost in year one is correlated with your cost in year two, is correlated with your cost in year three. And therefore, your cost at the time of censoring was going to be correlated with your costs had you completed the trial. And this is a problem. So people thought about this, and eventually they came up with a completely non-parametric estimate, which is a good thing. So just by way of motivating it, suppose that we had no censoring. And then our difference in means would be a difference in means where you just calculate a mean for group one and a mean for group two, and we subtract them. Here, xi is an indicator variable for whether or not the patient receives the trial treatment. With censored data, it turns out that you can get a consistent estimate of delta C by just restricting our attention to those patients who have their costs observed, so when delta I is equal to 1, and you weight it by the inverse of the probability of being observed. And it's a sort of, it was well known that if you do this, you end up getting a consistent estimator of delta C. Problem is that it doesn't make awfully good use of the data. So supposing that I was in the trial, and it was a 5-year trial, and I decided to drop out at the end of year 4. With this estimator, I would contribute no data. So what people said was, we can reduce the loss of information due to censoring, because people will drop out, by collecting cost data, not just at the end of year 5, but we're going to collect it, for example, at end of year 1, end of year 2, end of year 3, etc. So now if I drop out at the end of year 4, I've already contributed to complete data for the first 4 years, and I'm just missing that final year. So how does this help us? Instead of just estimating the overall difference in costs, we're going to do it year by year. So we're going to calculate the mean difference in costs for year 1, and for year 2, and for year 3, and then we're just going to add them all up. And so this estimator is pretty much exactly the same as we had before. It's just that Cik is the cost to patient I in interval k. Delta Ik is equal to 1 if it's observed and 0 otherwise. And pi Ik is the probability that it's equal to 1. And then one final refinement is that statisticians like models. And someone said, well, can we just fit a linear semi-parametric model to this data where the expected cost for patient I in interval k is a linear function of the covariance? Typically, the first zi is going to be a vector. The first element is always going to be 1, so we have an intercept. The second element is going to be a treatment group indicator. And then you might have anything else you want to put in there, like age, gender, anything like that. Why is this interesting? Because the second component of beta k is your mean difference in costs for interval k. And so if we add them all up, we get delta c, which was the thing that we were after. And it turns out that a very simple way of estimating this beta is to solve this estimating equation. So it's a similar idea to what we had before, where we've still got this delta, so it's equal to 1 if you observe Cik and 0 otherwise, and we're going to weight it by the inverse probability that delta is 1. And it's fairly easy to show that solving this equation will give you a consistent estimator for beta. So that sounds good. And just note that in the special case where there is no censoring, delta is equal to 1 for everyone, and so is pi. So what you wind up solving are ordinary least squares equations. This is the point where I started my PhD. And so we've done an awful lot of work to start thinking about this problem, start thinking about incremental net benefit instead of funny ratios. We've done a lot of work to get consistent estimators, so estimators which are, for large sample size, approximately unbiased. And then we have the luxury of thinking about efficiency. So my supervisor said, can you find a more efficient way of estimating beta? And there'd been a lot of theoretical work that had been done, so effectively what I needed to do was to take all this theoretical to biostatisticians who are quite applied, rather complicated work, and apply it to this particular problem. So I looked up the reference, and I plowed through lots of very complicated Hilbert spaces and sigma algebras, and I hadn't done that for a while, so I came up with this nice complicated formula, and I felt very proud of myself because it had lots of nice symbols and stuff. and I'm not going to explain them because it's kind of not the point. But then I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, well, what's the special case of this where there's no censoring? What does this reduce to? And it turns out that this G thing is effectively my pi ik that I had before. So if there's no censoring, that denominator is always 1. And delta ij is always 1. And this thing ends up being the inverse of the variance of the vector of costs. And I thought, well, so what I'm doing here, if there's no censoring, is I'm solving the weighted least squares equations. And looking back, this is all very well and good, but what was more important in terms of improving efficiency is that here, instead of thinking about separate estimation problems for each year, I'm thinking about my cost as one big vector, and I'm going to do analysis on the vector rather than on solving 5 or 10 separate univariate problems. And the more I think about this, I think, well, what were we thinking? Statisticians don't usually think about their data in this way. For example, we might collect cost data every month. If we have a 5-year study, we've got 60 of these intervals. What are we, and we're fitting separate intercepts and treatment effects for each and every interval. So in this case, I have 10 time intervals. I've got 20 parameters. If I had 60 time intervals, I would just unquestioningly fit 20 different 120 different parameters. And in any other field, statisticians really don't think about data this way. Usually, if we encountered a problem like this, we'd probably just fit a single intercept and a single treatment effect. If we were feeling adventurous, we might say, well, we're going to let the intercepts change over time. So we're going to fit an intercept on a slope. And if we're feeling really, really adventurous, we might say, well, I'm going to let the treatment effects change over time. And on an extremely good day, we might think about putting splines on these things or something, so these things are allowed to vary according to a smooth curve. So looking back, it just seemed totally bizarre that for some reason we were fitting a completely stratified model where we're fitting separate parameters to each interval. And so now I'm going to show you how this all works in a clinical trial. This SIDS trial was the Canadian Implantable Defibrillator Study. So it's about 650 patients at risk of having a heart attack. And it was a randomized trial where half the patients were given amiodarone, which I think is a drug, and half of them were fitted with an implantable defibrillator, which I think is something that sort of goes into your heart, and when it thinks you're about to have a heart attack, it gives you a little shock. cost data is collected from the first 430 patients, and costs are collected every quarter, and they're followed for 6.4 years, so you end up with about 26 time intervals. Turns out you can make things a little bit easier because there's no censoring in the first 10 intervals, so you can just aggregate the data up. You end up with 17 time intervals. So then I was wondering, well, let's just fit the usual model which people have been fitting to this kind of data, where we fit a separate intercept and a separate treatment effect for every interval. And I'm going to call this the stratified model. And I'm going to look at two different ways of estimating the betas from that model. One is the inverse probability weighted estimator, and one is my fancy semi-parametric estimator. And then I thought, well, let's just think about the simple model that statisticians would usually fit if they were thinking like statisticians normally think, and fit a single intercept and a single treatment effect. This is the usual model for longitudinal data, and I'm going to call it the pooled model, because we're pooling information across time intervals. And again, I'm going to use the inverse probability estimator and the fancy semi-parametric efficient estimator. So these are the results. For the stratified estimators, you found out that amiodarone cost about an extra $49,000. What interested me the most was the standard errors. And here, the standard error goes from about 3,970, and it drops a tiny little bit to 3,943. And it was a real pain to code all that, so I was kind of disappointed. Then I tried fitting the pooled model, and your estimate stays about the same for the inverse probability weighted estimator. Your standard error goes a bit down a bit. Then what really, like, disappointed me was like when I fitted the pooled estimator with my fancy semi-parametric model, was that the standard error went way up, and it wasn't supposed to do that. And so I looked at my code, I thought I'd done something wrong. Eventually I did what statisticians would normally do, which is to look at the data. This is a plot of the estimated treatment contrast over time. And so my pooled model assumes that this is constant. And yeah, it's not really constant. So having looked at this model, we're just looking at the solid line right now, which is the fitted coefficient from my completely stratified model. And you notice that costs tend to be higher. It tends to sort of follow this periodic thing where costs tend to be higher in the first quarter of the year. Don't know why, but they are. And there tends to be a year effect. So what I ended up fitting was a model where you have separate effects for each year of study and separate effects for each season, but I don't fit the interaction. So instead of fitting 17 different coefficients, I fit however many that is, about 8. So I fit this model. Oh, and incidentally, when you fit this model, you get the dotted line, so it actually fits rather well. And the revised results, if you fit the inverse probability weighted estimator, you still end up with about 49,000 and a standard error, which isn't that great. What I was really excited about was that the semi-parametric efficient estimator had a really big reduction in standard error. And this is important because studies are typically not powered to estimate costs with a particularly good precision. So if we can reduce the standard error of the estimator of cost, then we can allow decision makers to make more informed decisions. So key points that I learned was that where the problem originated affects how we think about it. In this example, this problem had arisen in health economics. I think people have been pressured to sort of give people results very fast. And for some reason, we were thinking about estimating a difference in means rather than thinking about estimating parameters from a model, which is the way statisticians usually think. What did I learn? Well, I learned that developing a good model for the data is at least as important as sort of plugging through fancy mathematics, which statisticians kind of should know anyway. And the main contribution of my thesis was to apply very well-known facts to a fairly well-studied estimation problem. But for some reason, people weren't thinking the way people normally think. I'd be fascinated to hear whether you know of similar stories where this happens.
Thank you.
No problem.